Jesus said, anyone who would follow me must take up her cross. When Charles asked me, Dr. Marsh asked me to speak about bearing the cross in the age of Trump, lessons from MLK and the civil rights movement for today, you might imagine that I felt pretty daunted by trying to fill that void, right? What would, you know, people used to wear those bracelets, WWJD, what would Jesus do? I'm like, what would MLK do, right? Brandy used to wear one?
I have one.
Oh, there you go.
It says WTFMJD.
What? We've radicalized the WWJD, the millennial version of the, not the Gen X version. So, in terms of thinking through how would I address this question, and how would I both pay homage and do justice to Dr. King, I thought, well, Risha, you study like kind of the holy trinity of profane things, race, religion, politics, you should be fine, right? And the reason is MLK actually embodied all of those things that are repugnant to the academy, by the way, repugnant, and culturally speaking, give us pause. These are the kinds of conversations you refuse to enter into. Millennials, the generation of tolerance, refuse to have these conversations about these tough issues amongst their peers, right? You'll have these conversations with people who are like-minded, but not across the divide. So we have what Putnam would call bonding social capital. The question is, are we bridging our differences across these racial, religious, political differences? And I think Dr. King would say, in his eloquent way, that in our future, the question of our differences is the question of nonviolence as non-existence, right? Your unwillingness, perhaps, to engage these questions could be the death knell, morally as well as civically as well as politically. So this is just a precursor to the things that I felt inspired to reread through the text that you guys are engaging in this class for today. One of the things that struck me, maybe we can talk about these in the conversation, is that there's a lot of learning that occurs over Dr. King's life. And even in the part that you get to glimpse, right, in these readings for today. And I think one of the things that struck me is, as a political scientist who takes quite seriously the intersection of these three things, how much learning I have to do as I'm teaching. And so for me, today is a learning opportunity. I'm not here, hopefully I'm here to both provoke and inspire, but also to learn with you as we work through these texts together. So I've divided my talk into three sections. The first will be prerequisites to cross-bearing, the second will be the nature of cross-bearing, and then the third will be, or characteristics of cross-bearing, and then the third will be the politics of cross-bearing towards a prophetic pragmatism. So the prerequisites to cross-bearing. I think that when we look at MLK's life, obviously modeled on the notion of Jesus bearing the cross, one of the first things that's a prerequisite to cross-bearing is body work. I think what MLK models both in his life and in his writing is that in order to be a whole society, in order to be rightly, like justice is just rightly ordered relationships, in order to achieve justice, we need to move from thinking of ourselves as separate parts, or even our individual selves as body parts, to being fully embodied. In the current context, in the context in which MLK was speaking and writing, this involves moving from atomic, individuated selves, a la capitalism, towards seeing ourselves in the midst of community. So from atomic individuated selves, a la capitalism, to seeing ourselves as part of a broader collective community. Also, MLK's image of the body was ensconced in this notion of the body of Christ, where the Apostle Paul speaks in Corinthians about the body of Christ being many members, but one. And the head can't work without the foot, and the arm can't work without the hand. And so this image of the body of Christ is one of a collective salvific significance, right? We cannot be saved apart from one another. We cannot be saved apart from the literal, metaphorical body of Jesus Christ crucified and then re-sacrificed in the Eucharist. We also can't live together without one another. Secondly, I think body work requires thinking about the fact that our bodies do work for us. Our bodies do work for us. So when I talk about our bodies doing work for us, as a political scientist, I want to drill into the heads of my students that politics is always embodied. When I walk into a classroom as a new professor at the University of Virginia, my body does work for me without me speaking. Before I open my mouth, my body has told a narrative, told a political, sung a political song without me opening my mouth, right? Body of a black woman in a university space, in a political science department. And if anyone knows something about my prior story, then that complicates maybe the narrative of my body, right? But in any event, my body does work for me. I think about the political sphere. We know that, and likewise, when people of any oppressed group try to speak for on their own behalf in political spheres, their bodies do work for them. So a prerequisite to cross-bearing is recognizing that not every body has the same attendant voice and agency that you presume is extant in this pluralistic society. That actually, voice and agency a la the political individual body is not assured. It is for the privileged and the powerful, but not for the oppressed. So this makes our vision, like, perhaps then focus more on the oppressed bodies in the political realm and in the civic realm than on those privileged ones in terms of how we think about body work and what it means to be that complete body. Third, this notion of moving beyond this atomistic, individualistic view of the self in the context of society, but also of religion. Think about American Christianity, especially white evangelicalism, the notion of individual salvation. You think about the extent to which this has permeated religion in all of our spheres, all of our institutions. What body work does is perhaps move us toward a view of Ubuntu. Ubuntu is an African proverb which simply means, I am because we are. We are because I am. There are many different translations. Bishop Desmond Tutu likes to speak about Ubuntu. It's this collective sensibility. MLK talks about it as a network of mutuality. All life is interrelated. We are caught up in an inescapable network of mutuality tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. And this is in the speech, The American Dream, that you read for today, from 1961. I also like to talk about it, I have to always read it because I want to change it to a seamless web of mutuality. Because when I read Dr. King's work and I think about Ubuntu, and no, don't mistake the fact that this is embedded in the African, West African kind of collective historical memory, this seamless web of mutuality, I think about interstitiality, that space between the bones, right? The interstitial area is what keeps, it's the equivalent of social capital. It's what keeps the body lubricated and able to move, those interstitial spaces. And those spaces between me and you and you and me They're interstitial. They're never broken, right? And so going beyond Ubuntu to interstitial thinking perhaps brings us to think about a notion of interbeing, which is what King is pointing us toward. Beyond some macro level vision of a collective unit, living that out in the interstitial spaces in our society and literally standing in the gap for the other with our body. That's what solidarity is. Standing in the gap for the other. Because we're so connected, it's just natural. That's the vision. That's the kind of body work that King is calling us toward. Solidarity. Theoretical solidarity is not solidarity at all. Solidarity in theory is not solidarity in fact. Okay, second prerequisite to cross-bearing. So those are all facets of body work. So first was body work. Second, soul work. Soul work is at the center of King's vision and his life. Soul work. It's at the center of his vision. As you read through the various letters that you were assigned for today, or for those of you who aren't in the class, if you think of King's speeches that you've read or heard, soul work is at the heart of King's vision. So what does soul work entail? Vision starts with the heart. It begins with seeing. In the book of Ephesians, the Apostle Paul prays for the church at Ephesus that their eyes might be enlightened, that the eyes of their heart, might be enlightened. So the Apostle Paul prays that the eyes of the hearts of the Ephesians might be enlightened. These are your eyes. The Apostle Paul is praying that these eyes, the eyes of the heart, heart interchangeable often with this notion of the soul, that the soul's eyes would be enlightened. Toward what end? For what purpose? In order to see the oppressed. It's not with our physical eyes that we see the oppressed. It's with the eyes of our heart that we see the oppressed. Toward justice for the oppressed is the end, and toward liberation for the oppressed. So eyes are to see what has truly been marked deplorable by society has actually been those things that Jesus says should be preferred in society. Also to see that what we've institutionalized and embodied as normative is actually truly deplorable often. We've instantiated inequality and called it the American way. Since 1970, the rich get richer, the poor get poorer. The salaries of CEOs have gone up 700 times since 1980. The average salary for CEOs, 700 times. So when we think through the eyes of the heart, we begin to see the reality that much soul work, much resting and wrestling and wrangling with God and the universe and self and the other is necessary to get toward a vision of justice, society rightly ordered. When you do soul work, you have to ask the question, what are you willing to sacrifice for Ubuntu? What are you willing to sacrifice for the good? And this is the constant question that MLK compels us to ask ourselves in these works. What are we willing to sacrifice for this vision of the good, for justice, for mercy, compassion? What will we sacrifice for the good? Okay, the third type, the third prerequisite for cross-bearing is footwork. Footwork. So we've got body work, we've got soul work, and then footwork. The gospel says, how beautiful are the feet of those who bring good news. They don't say that the message They don't talk about the word. They don't talk about the rhetoric. They don't talk about the framing of the narrative. It's the feet of those who bear the news. And this is because gospel really means, in some translation, putting feet to faith. Putting feet to faith. So putting feet to our activism is what MLK calls us to do. Putting feet to our stated commitments. And this is what MLK embodies in his life, in the civil rights movement, is this notion of actually putting feet to faith. If you know the background story of Selma and the Pettus Bridge, you know there are moments in his work, which he considered his ministry, that he was fearful, right? That he wasn't sure whether he should lead the charge, right? So the question is not one of whether or not fear arises in our hearts and in our souls. Even if we've done the soul work, fear will be extant. The question is, will you put feet to faith? And this requires some chutzpah, right? The courage, civil courage that Professor Marsh was speaking about. So this is how MLK states this in the letter in the vein of Apostle Paul. Wouldn't you love to be at a sermon like that? There will be many white persons of goodwill and strong moral sensitivity who will dare to take a stand for justice. Honesty impels me to admit that such a stand will require willingness to suffer and sacrifice. So don't despair if you are condemned and persecuted for righteousness' sake. Whenever you take a stand for truth and justice, you are liable to scorn. Often you will be called an impractical idealist or a dangerous radical. Sometimes it might mean going to jail. If such is the case, you must honorably grace the jail with your presence. It might even mean physical death. But if physical death is the price that some must pay to free their children from a permanent life of psychological death, then nothing could be more Christian. So putting feet to faith. And let's talk about the characteristics of cross-bearing. The characteristics of cross-bearing. First, cross-bearing is rather bloody. Cross-bearing is bloody. Again, when David Garrow, in his Pulitzer Prize-winning book, talks about MLK bearing the cross, the image is not, it's not merely metaphorical, it's a visceral one. The cross, the imagery of the cross being borne, Jesus rode to Golgotha in Scripture, is a bloody image. It's an image of toil. It's an image of loneliness. We'll talk about more of these, but it's a bloody image. Taking up one's cross requires suffering. And this brings us back to soul work, because you have to have done your soul work in order to take on suffering willingly. Bloody cross-bearing is a constant dark night of the soul, because it entails being overwhelmed constantly with the weight of the world, which is literally the image of the cross, bearing the weight of the sin of the world on one's shoulders. Not out of a sense of martyrdom, but out of a sense of, again, commitment to justice. So cross-bearing always entails bloodiness. Secondly, cross-bearing is subversive. Cross-bearing may appeal to status quo narratives for a time, but ultimately, cross-bearers and their messages eclipse the current paradigm. It upsets the apple cart. It makes the powerful uncomfortable. When's the last time you smuggled notes on some toilet paper out of jail? That's the letter from the Birmingham jail. When's the last time you wrote from a prison cell in Hanoi in your own blood? Cross-bearing is bloody, and it's also subversive and subversively persistent in its demand for justice. Third, cross-bearing is alienating. It entails alienation. It's lonely. It's isolating. Cross-bearers do not have many allies and even fewer accomplices. If you listen to Reverend Jesse Jackson speak, he was here in Charlottesville, was that September? He's so connected to Dr. King. Dr. King's words flow from his mouth. They were that close. He had a small group, a small inner group. Reverend Jackson was one among them. But cross-bearing is lonely. The kinds of crosses that figures like, prophetic figures like MLK bear. Cross-bearing, like another characteristic, is scapegoatism. The cross-bearer is often a scapegoat for the public's sins. But I want you to notice that even in his black respectability, talk, laced throughout many of these readings you had for today, Dr. King evinces this kind of black respectability. He pits himself, this black elite, educated elite, right, over and against what he perceives as black rabble rousers, right? Calls the Malcolm X's and the Black Panthers, by the way, the ones who, on the down low, were protecting his life, the rabble rousers. But he was considered a rabble rouser. His public approval ratings in 1963 in the United States were lower than Khrushchev's public approval ratings at the height of the Cold War. That's how much of a rabble-rouser Dr. King was considered in 1963. And you all consider that to be the tipping point, right? Because 64 was the Voting Rights Act. COINTELPRO, right? I mean, why, since the beginning of his ministry, you know, was he a target of J. Edgar Hoover in the United States government? He was dangerous. He was a scapegoat for the sins of America and for the failure of the government that he was calling truth to power. He was a scapegoat, right, for the sins of the country, for the sins, the failures of the United States that sends its troops to black troops to Vietnam. That's later than 63, right? But he is the scapegoat. He's the one. He's the lightning rod. He's the one who receives the brunt of the criticism for all that vexes black America and white America. He's a scapegoat. He's the problem. He's not the solution. He's seen as the problem. But he, too, has a problem with calling out other folks in the nexus of the movement doing a different thing. So let that also be a lesson to us about lack of perfection. All right. Also, a characteristic of cross-bearing is it's like Groundhog Day. Do millennials know the movie Groundhog Day? Please tell me that. Please tell me that that's like just a cultural iconic film. Okay, like Napoleon Dynamite in my estimation. Groundhog Day and Nacho Libre. Groundhog Day. Cross-bearing is iterative. It's never enough. The work of a prophet is never done. It's the same song over and over and over, and you see that throughout his writing. He gives a lot of speeches, you give a lot of talks, you borrow phrases from yourself, right? But this was also mixed in with a new kind of urgency when he moves towards Vietnam War, right, and economics. The last speech he gives, he's hinting towards the Poor People's Campaign, right? The last speech, the last sermon he gives, his last speech, which you haven't read yet, at least it wasn't in the reading for it today, but he's speaking towards labor movement, right? And so I think it's important to realize that a characteristic of cross-bearing is that your work is never done. Every day, it's new shit. Every day, it's new injustice. Every day, you wake up depressed and go to bed depressed. Because it's the same shit in a different package. So the constant injustice is like Groundhog Day. Also, a characteristic of cross-bearing is that cross-bearing is in the Greek sense of this, in the sense of scripture, it's a kairos moment. It's a kairos moment. A kairos moment is not a chronos moment. We're not talking about chronological time. We're talking about space and time where the moment is always ripe for justice. The moment is always ripe for justice in Kairos because the moment for the universe is now. The moment to do justice is always now. 500 years post the Protestant Reformation, we can assess, and again, Dr. King is named after the great Protestant reformer. My Jamaican friend likes to call it, and my Catholic friend here will appreciate this, the Protestants, like the protesters. So I like to think of the Protestants as ushering a particular kind of revolution, but the revolution was from within the church. We tend to forget that. The revolution was meant to be from within the church, and the moment is always ripe for justice, and the moment is always now. And it's important to realize that it's always the oppressed who are called to bear the burden of indifference to injustice and the inertia in addressing it. So to paraphrase Dr. King, the tires on the wheels of inevitability have always been flat. The tires on the wheels of inevitability have always been flat. The notion that justice will come incrementally, the notion that change is going to come if you're patient. Wait your turn. Get in line, immigrants. Get in line, Muslims, right? The question about the timelessness of the moment really pushes us towards a sense of urgency in movements and in these moments. Okay, finally, let's talk about the politics of cross-bearing. Check the time. The politics of cross-bearing. And I call this prophetic pragmatism. The tension of our time, our political time, is this. And this is not what you will hear people talking about on CNN and MSNBC. But this is the tension of our time. It's between a Rawlsian, John Rawls, commitment to justice as fairness, that is, justice as merely the working out of issues and problems according to the mechanisms at our disposal in governmental spheres. And doing so with the background of overlapping consensus of various conceptions of the good, so relegating our various commitments, our ideological commitments, our commitments to various faiths or no faiths, our philosophical commitments to the background, that he calls these private reasons, as subordinate to public reasons. But even the great theorist, John Rawls, who conceives of a liberal democracy as predicated on this notion of justice as fairness, with no respect for the person, with no respect for private reasons, he says, except for the prophets. Except for the prophets. The only time that private reasons are meant to be or able to be utilized in the public square is in moments of great crisis societally. And at that point in time, the prophets' voices are relevant. We also hold Rawls in tension with the annoying optimism of Alexis de Tocqueville and Gunnar Myrdal, the kind of fawning optimism about the American creed. the notion that democracy will prevail in the end. Another theory of inevitability. And those are two tensions that we have to weigh, that the prophet has to weigh, as they do politics in the public sphere. So when we think about MLK's prophetic side, the prophet is always calling truth to power. It's the siren song, railing against government and society's active intransigence and its passive indifference. They've preached destruction for societies that continue to do injustice for individuals, for institutions. They call society towards the truth. And I want to point you to the fact that throughout MLK's writings that you read for today, the truth is packaged in this. It's packaged in a message of love and human dignity. Love and human dignity. Obviously, in a Christian context, Judeo-Christian context, love for God, love for self, love for neighbor. But human dignity, I want to point out to you, precedes human rights. Human rights is a fiction if human dignity is not extant. And so what MLK is pointing us to is to recapture a vision, a prophetic vision, of human dignity, where the first are last and the last are first, where the perspective of the oppressed is actually vaunted and vaulted above the privileged and powerful. But also, I would like for you to see throughout his propheticness that there's humility. There's humility in prophecy. Because the constancy of the prophetic witness imbues a kind of humility about the limited nature of one's vision. So the limited nature of one's vision is clear in MLK's writing. Okay, the pragmatic part of prophetic pragmatism. What's clear throughout the evolution of King's learning is he's always asking himself a question, and he epitomizes this in one of the later writings, I think perhaps the one on Vietnam. He calls us to creative protest. Creative protest. The pragmatist is not a utilitarian, because the pragmatist is guided by a moral proclivity toward justice. He constantly talks about methods and means, right? That the method must be just, a kind of just war, right? He's always asking the question, how do I love my enemy even during war? So much so that it's annoying, right? Like, we have to love the white brothers who have held us down and who enslaved us and stuff, right? But that's all towards a moral proclivity, prioritizing love, prioritizing the dignity of the human person, prioritizing the dignity of the oppressor. So the pragmatist says what works, not in a utilitarian sense, but out of a practical bent towards creative protest as injustice takes on many new and different forms. So MLK is a prophetic pragmatist, tweaking his strategy at the margins, changing his focus, despite much criticism and critique. Aren't you a preacher? Why are you talking about war? Aren't you a preacher? Why are you in cahoots with labor? Are you a preacher? Why are you now doing politics, right? So prophetic pragmatism is the model of MLK's life. So now for the question, which the political scientist Larisha is supposed to answer for all of her friends and now for you. What would MLK say to Trump? And what should we do in the era of Trump? I think he would say several things. I think, as he says in one of the letters that you read for today, there are guided missiles and misguided hands, And I'm not talking about Kim Jong-un. I'm talking about Donald Trump. I think he would say, you shall know them by their fruits. And ask the 81% of white evangelicals who voted for him, where's the fruit? I think he would warn us about false prophets and wolves in sheep's clothing. I think he would say, you are your brother and sister's keeper, and their blood cries out to you from the ground. Do you see it? I think he would say to Trump, the eyes of your heart are blind to the suffering and the injustice of the most oppressed in your midst. I think he would say to Trump and his board of religious advisors, you are whitewashed tombs. You glow and you glisten on the outside, but you are empty on the inside. I think he would say to the Congress of the United States, you call yourselves righteous, but the prophet Isaiah says righteousness and justice go hand in hand, and that in fact kingdoms and cities will be redeemed by justice, and that nevertheless, your princes are rebels and companions of thieves. I think he would say to most of us in this room, how are you complicit in the vast inequality that masquerades as the truth of the American dream? You'd say, do you give a damn that the least of these young children on the south and west sides of Chicago, where I live when I'm not in Virginia, we have committed them, we've relegated them to a life of hell and destruction? Do you question why they kill one another? Because we assassinate them by sending them into institutions that are a revolving door to prisons, and many of them get a record at the age of 7. He would ask us how open the eyes of our hearts are. He would ask President Trump, to get caught up in a vortex of love. Heather Heyer's father said at her funeral, it didn't matter who you were or where you were from. If she loved you, you were stuck. He would ask President Trump, who do you love? What do you love? And he would ask us the same question. He would ask us, I think, to think a little more like gangsters, because that's what Trump is. And so to fight the gangster, we have to learn to think like the gangster, to change our thinking. This is a different kind of paradigm, qualitatively different. He would also say, Republicans, Democrats aren't so different. Obama was the best drone president we ever had. And don't forget that. He would say, Republicans and Democrats are not so different. Don't forget that. Don't put your eggs in that basket. It's a false basket. It's a false binary. The choice is between life and death. So I think he would call Trump towards real choices as opposed to false choices. You're called Truth to Power. He would also remind us that all politics are local, because as much as he talked about the NAACP, the civil rights movement moved because of local movement centers. He would call us to remember that all politics is local. Charlottesville. What happens here matters and has national and international ripple effects. We saw that. And he would call us to believe that. All politics is local. I think he would call us to remember that it's never enough. Maybe to choose to be a little more depressed on a daily basis, which would mean that we have decided not to make peace with oppression. So MLK Jr.'s message to Trump would be much like his message to us. But elites are always held to a higher standard, according to scripture. Teachers, preachers, politicians are held to a different standard because they have the power and the privilege of setting the narrative. So I think MLK's message to Trump and to us would be, again, to engage in ways that are prophetic and pragmatic, and to continue to have hope. And I think one of the things that is difficult in these days and these times is the question of hope. And one of the things that fueled MLK in the dark night of the soul is this. When you wake up in the dark, from the dark night of your soul, and you have a song in your heart, you know you have something within you, something that compels you to do justice in the face of injustice, and something that tells you and compels you that to believe that this is worth dying for. So I think he would ask us, what are we willing to die for? Are we willing to die for the cause of justice, for the cause of human dignity, to take seriously our interstitiality, to take seriously that we are one, and that we are to be radically pouring out ourselves for the other? And he would call President Trump to do the same. That's what I think he would say. Thoughts?
Thank you.
Questions? Do you
want to
do a few questions?
Yes, we do. We have some time for Well, that was.
I have a few more notes. About
yeah.
That I was going to open, but then I got. But I mean, also we could talk about the text. There were a lot of kind of quotes that I took out. I thought about different points of putting in here, but did not.
Can we just see what? What the response is?
Yeah.
Heavy and important and urgent words. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you need.
Capitalism has transformed our conception of the self is everything's a transaction. Everything in our lives is transactional. If you hear how people talk about Trump's leadership style, he's talked about as a transactional mm-hmm. leader. You've got transformational leaders, you've got transactional leaders. MLK is a transformational mm-hmm. leader, right? Leading us towards self-revelation, toward other revelation, toward reforming not just ourselves, but the society in which we live. Transformational leaders, right? Do the kind of bridging social capital that Putnam talks about. Whether you buy Putnam's, you know, methods and argument or not, that's a whole context, right? But the concept itself is a nice way of thinking through. Transactional is the notion that, and this is reflected in a lot of the methodologies that we study, right? Like rational choice theory. This notion that we rank order our preferences. Whatever we prefer is what we choose, right? And that other considerations don't weigh into those calculations, and that really the way of the world is the way of rational economic man. And the way that there was a shift after Adam Smith wrote The Wealth of Nations toward the utilization of economic words, even in literature and in our language. So there are entire books about the way that capitalism even permeates. I mean, you talk about people being entrepreneurial, right? So there are so many ways that capitalism permeates our daily existence that we don't think about, right?
No.
So, you know, we talk about religion. Religion used to be talked about, you think about Weber's Protestant ethic and the spirit of capitalism. You know, this notion of chosenness. Now salvation is another market choice, and it's a market preference, right? You choose religion amongst your many other kinds of choices that you make, as opposed to being chosen, right? So it even changes theology, like how we think about theology now is through these prisms of choice, as opposed to thinking through, so Arminianism notwithstanding, as opposed to thinking through religion through the lenses of the work of God and the work of the church. Now it's this individual, salvific. It's also come out in terms of the prosperity gospel. Prosperity gospel is predicated on this notion of, you know, Jesus as your business coach, health and wealth, the notion that if you work hard enough, if you pray hard enough and you work hard enough, you will be materially blessed, not just spiritually blessed. So there are all kinds of ways that capitalism permeates not just religion, but our daily lives in terms of how we go about interacting with other citizens, right? So, yeah.
I'm wondering if you could speak to, you started, the last things you were saying brought this to my mind, and it probably fits under one of the categories under characteristics of mm-hmm. cross-bearing, but the nature of prophetic witness and even public work like this being misunderstood and falsely narrated. Even I think at hearing you speak just then and thinking about even MLK, even this kind of witness to the point of death is still going to be misunderstood and misnarrated and cast in this light that's totally false and kind of propagated to the masses.
Can you give an example of how you're saying, like,
for instance, I grew up in the Bible Belt and in the South and in a very white upbringing, and almost everything I heard about MLK was cast in a negative light, mm-hmm. even though he had lived with more integrity than anybody that I've read about in my, like, in mm-hmm. this era, even to the point of dying for what he believed in. Mm-hmm. And yet the narrative that was, I guess, propagated to me and a lot of my peers was, you know, this guy was X, he was not this. Mm-hmm. And just made me even think about Christ, you know, even in his death and resurrection, the narratives that came shortly thereafter also were in many ways false.
Sure. Good. So one of the things that I thought about bringing up, but it's a whole other can of worms, is the notion of redemptive violence. And what I also want to say and caution against in talking about suffering to the point of death and the willingness of the prophet, like, this is why we don't call everyone prophets, right, as well. This is why this is a category we don't. So, but I do, you know, I used to work at a Christian school, and I would use this paradigm, right, this prophetic paradigm, and thinking about, well, what does solidarity look like if it's not the professor sitting in the classroom telling you to go do justice and love mercy and walk humbly with God and the universe and your neighbor, right? That's all nice and good. At a school where we're supposed to, like, mentor students, they're like, oh, yeah, that's good. You talk to Micah. But really, what I decided what I wanted to say to them was that this prayer that changed my life, which is the book, it's from the Book of Common Prayer from 1929, and I like the thou stuff, but it's not gender neutral. But what it says is something about God grant us grace to fearlessly contend against evil. We know it when we see it, right? People are talking a lot more about evil since November 2016 than they have my whole life, right? And to pursue the maintenance of justice among humans and nations, may we never make peace with oppression. So that became kind of my guiding mantra, my guiding prayer as a political scientist. Like, what does that look like? As government's all about justice. Government's about justice in the public realm. That's it. Justice is rightly ordered relationships in society, period. That's what it means in the biblical texts. That's what it means when governments talk about justice. It's the means that government utilizes, the politics, to accomplish justice that are contentious. But the notion of governments doing justice in the public realm, that's what governments are ordained to do in the biblical sense. And so thinking through what this prophetic looks like vis-a-vis institutions and individuals, it's not this. It's not you get to decide to be a martyr. It's not a messiah complex, right? This is why soul work is a prerequisite. Because the person who takes seriously the work of justice, that the work of justice as a life calling, right, and the dark night of the soul, and what it takes to accomplish movements, especially in the, over and against particularly vexing kind of problems that we're talking about here, has to be prepared to die. But the prophet doesn't rush in like volunteering to die, right? The prophet is called to work toward justice, right? So I would tell my students, I had a student come to me one time and she said, she grew up in Honduras and she said, I want to major in peace and conflict studies because I want to go be a police in Honduras. Do you know anything about the police in Honduras? They kill citizens. I said, I don't think your parents want you to go work as a police in Honduras in 2 years so that you can reform from within because you'll be killed. Like, this is stupid. I told her, that's stupid. But let's think about what are your goals and how can you work towards justice in Honduras in the legal realm? Is that what you're interested in? So we had this long conversation, but she was trying to martyr her. I was like, you don't get to be a martyr. You're made a martyr. You're made a martyr. You don't choose to be a martyr. You choose to do the work of justice. And so you're right. I would also say about the MLK analyses, this is why we need intersectional analysis. Like, how much of this comes from his race? A lot of this comes from, if you grew up in the buckle of the Bible Belt, MLK had affairs, COINTELPRO recorded them. If you're salacious, you can go listen to them, whatever. A lot of it comes from, he can't be a good man because he has, King David notwithstanding, Bathsheba, blah, blah, blah. But MLK cannot be a good man because he had an affair. He didn't kill the woman's husband like King David did. But, MLK can't be a prophet in the line of prophets because he's black. That's it. So it'll tell you that narrative affected me growing up in the buckle of the Bible Belt in a white evangelical context. Like, how am I supposed to appropriate these things? It's damaging. It's harmful. But I think the prophet stands out in this way. But I think the prophet understands they might be called to die. Not all prophets are killed. Many of them are. But they're committed to the cause. As long as they're on earth, they're committed to the cause. That's why his last speech is so eerie. It's like he knew he wasn't going to make it to the promised land. And he did it. So. What else?
kind of going way back to the prerequisites when we were discussing body work, I thought there was just a lot of like content in there, and I understand the idea that the body work kind of goes beyond like mental decision, and it almost becomes just a natural kind of reflex to do what's correct. But I was just wondering if you could clarify what you meant back when literally you said we consider ourselves as like fully embodied part of a larger community, particularly in where is identity within that community?
Oh no, so when I, this is a good question. So I was trying to say we need to go from body parts to being embodied selves in a larger community, right? So wanting to maintain this notion of uniqueness and identity and individuality, right? But moving beyond the kind of transactional self that really, you know, capitalism is also this notion that, to finish Nathan's question, that the common good accrues from the base level of individual transactions, right? So part of this is thinking of how do we move beyond this, this kind of pernicious belief that permeates like even the religious sectors of our society that ideally are working towards the common good, at least presumptively and ostensibly, that towards this notion that there is something beyond the individual atomized self. And the embodied self takes seriously the self, right? Takes seriously one's identity, one's placement in the context of various kinds of communities, because we're not all parts of one kind of community either, right? So identity is really central, I think, to taking seriously the embodied self. But part of the embodiment is also taking seriously, like you mentioned, the various facets of the self, right? I think one of the things that we're prone to in an academic context is overemphasizing the intellect to the detriment of the body, right? So you're students, right? And you're called to use this all the time, so much so that many universities have a phys ed requirement, right? Usually it's your freshman year, so you take some gym class and then you forget that you're supposed to care for this, right? But thinking of the body is not separable, like we're not all minds, we're not all, you know, labor is not just labor. There's a soul, there's an intellect there, right? So thinking of ourselves as embodied is really taking seriously our individual identity. So it's not this, it's not meant to be this notion of dissolving the self in favor of the communal. So thank you for that clarifying question. Is, right? Yes?
So you mentioned kind of false binaries when you were talking about Republicans and Democrats, and being that we're fired for staying solidarity with Muslims, I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on the false binaries of how we view race and how we view religion.
Sure.
Just speak to that.
So, I mean, in terms of false binaries, I think, I mean, obviously race is a social construct, but I'm a student of history and I'm a student of politics. And I also think that we over-spiritualize race in this country, calling it America's original sin drives me crazy. What I think is important is to know America's original sin is the genocide of the natives, right? Attacking bodies, right? Not because they were native per se, decimating bodies, but because of this notion, the doctrine of discovery, the Catholic Church, you know, setting the way. So race is a social construct, period, end of conversation. But race is real. It's real. And people need to be liberated from oppression. And I love to go to Brazil or Germany, and they tell me, we don't see race and we don't have a problem with race. Like, hell you do. You do, right? You call it something different, but you have a problem with race and ethnicity. You have a problem with Islam. And in Germany, they're very clear that they're interested in an assimilation project, period. Period. Right? So I think race remains a central feature of American political development, and it always will. I'm not hopeful in that way that these racial categories are going to go away. They haven't gone away yet. I think we're in interesting times, right? Some Hispanics can claim themselves white, some Latinos do. They can pass just like half of Sally Hemings' relatives passed as white and half their children and half did not, right? Race is a category, but it is with us. And I'm just not very hopeful. I'm not hopeful that that's going anywhere. And that's, for me, that's, it's one of those constant struggles in this country. I teach what I teach because I'm interested in doing work towards reconciliation on those fronts, justice on those fronts. But you ask me what I think about segregated Sundays, I'm not very hopeful. I'm more interested in you, instead of white people coming to my black church, I would rather white people go to a Muslim mosque. I think that's where, to get to your religion question, that's where we need to have other kinds of interfaith, across faith, there's a different term because everyone's not a person of faith that I like to use instead, kind of interspiritual conversations, because again, that's another kind of dividing line that I think will always be with us as well. I mean, as a Christian, I have different kinds of hope. I think we all come from the mothership, the Catholic Church. My secret hope is that we would all go back to the mothership, that we would just be one. But I don't see that happening either. I'm not hopeful on the race front or on the like religious fracturing front itself. As long as we have humans, we'll have division, right? Conflict is part of human nature. But I am hopeful about efforts toward reconciliation. And that doesn't mean we should try to alleviate the segregated nature of our churches, right? Whatever stripe that they are. But there was new data that I saw today that mosques are the most multicultural spaces, religious spaces in the country. I suspected that given the fact that I've gotten to visit a lot of mosques in the past 2 years after wearing the hijab in solidarity with Muslim women. That was my, I had anecdotal evidence, but now I have data that that's true. So I think we need to look at different spaces for hope to figure out what they're doing. Of course, Islam is a worldwide religion, so is Christianity. But somehow, Muslims have managed to bridge that racial and ethnic gap, which is not to say there aren't problems within mosques, because I've also heard narratives and stories about, especially by class, within mosques, because that's class
difference. This is fabulous, and we need to take a break shortly. If you don't mind, I'd just like to ask a quick question.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we'll take a break. There's coffee. Those of you who would like, we'll reconvene for another 45 minutes or so with some student-led questions. And then, obviously, I understand that many of you need to go. But just sort of building on those last two questions, I really appreciated the way you finished and formulated those questions to Trump from MLK and the Civil Rights Movement. And it made me think of a question he asked King, Dr. King, often, but unforgettably from a letter from Birmingham City Jail of the white Protestant evangelical church in the South, surveying these elaborate and lavish institutions and their campuses and building projects and programs. He sort of admired their zeal and their entrepreneurial organization, and yet asked who is the God they worship. And it's a question that I've thought about and after King, I don't think ever was able to understand who the God of the white evangelical South was, or what that God would look like, and the sort of theological components of that God. One of the most poignant stories I remember from research I was doing on the Montgomery bus boycott years ago was a file of letters that King had written in the early days of the boycott, you know, by the end of 1955, really within the first week, to clergy in Montgomery. Mm-hmm. He wrote every white clergyman to invite them to a mass meeting that was being held at Dexter Avenue Baptist Church. And I had a graduate student once, Richard Wills, who's now a pastor in Atlanta, who had actually been the pastor at Dexter Avenue for 9 years before he came into this doctorate here. He wrote a wonderful book on King called The Idea of the Imago Dei and Martin Luther King. Richard had access to all the church archives at Dexter and showed me these copies of these letters. So what's heartbreaking about this is that he handwrote 35, 36 invitations to white clergy. And, you know, as Richard frames the story and as people I've talked to who were parishioners at Dexter at the time, he was hopeful that this gesture of reconciliation would be reciprocated by many. And, you know, there you read through volume 3, as we've done, of the Montgomery Bus Book, a 600-page kind of document. And, you know, it's saturated in this kind of language of reconciliation, beloved community, redemption, and the like. And his hopes are kind of heartbreakingly, you know, from our perspective now, naive, but inspiring. And no one came. And maybe one or two, according to Richard, who looked at these more carefully, responded with, you know, have something else to do that night. And so, you know, I think King was haunted until the end by the shape and character of this construction of the white evangelical church. So I want to ask you, because I don't know the answer to the question, who is the God that this 83% that you mentioned earlier of white evangelical Christians voting for Trump, who is the God they worship? You're, you know, fresh out of the subculture.
Yeah.
And I am perplexed. And I wonder if you can offer any perspective on that.
So I think the first, I have many thoughts, but I think one of the things that's difficult is I've never considered myself an evangelical except to the extent that all Christians are evangelical, supposedly, right? Like called to share the good news with their feet. And I think one of the things that stands out to me most in thinking about how white evangelical Christianity works, what it does, what it produces, right? Again, there's a capitalist word, but in terms of what it produces, but there's also a word of growth, right? You know them by their fruit, is it's highly, not unlike Trump, transactional. So I've been thinking through as a political scientist, what allows people who profess to follow the same radical Jesus that I follow, right? I also think it's a different view of Jesus as well. So I think soteriology, which is salvation, right? Like soteriology is quite different because it's individual, it's transactional. In the black church that I grew up in, you know the narratives I grew up hearing? My God delivered Daniel from the lion's den, and God will deliver me. God delivered Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. It's a collective. God delivered the Hebrews from Pharaoh's hand. Those are the messages of salvation that I grew up hearing, and they're collective messages of salvation, which imbues you with a collective notion of sin, right? We are our brother's keeper. I have responsibility. I bear the burden of responsibility for the pains of my black and brown community on the south and the west side of Chicago. I did that. That is me. I am the problem. And so white transactional evangelicalism is able to push Trump, because Trump's transactional just like them. You get out what you put in. What they want out is pro-life, anti-gay, right? Obama, keep your hands off our, you know, anti-reproductive rights. Seriously, we even sued the federal government over healthcare because they didn't want to provide birth control to people like me on their insurance because it could be abortive. My OBGYN sister says, are you 486 WICs the same way as yes, actually? This isn't a question about abortion. It's a question about the mechanism of a pill. It's all the same. It's the same. So these questions are then subsumed under the label and the banner of morality when it's really politics. So it's also politics masquerading as morality. And it's wholly transactional in the way that elections in this country are. And in the way that the vapidness of that phrase, America's original sin, is just what John Kelly said this week, right?
What did he say? Sorry.
What did John Kelly say this week, people?
We didn't negotiate.
We didn't negotiate on the Civil War.
Yeah.
Didn't compromise.
Sorry.
Yeah.
So I think it's
end of honor. See Wendell Pierce's tweet.
No, I didn't.
Yeah, it was wonderful.
But I think
share
it's,
with you later.
Yeah, it's this transactional vision, and it's no, there's no culpability, actually. If you weren't the individual involved in the transaction, you have no culpability for that collective sin. It's not collective sin. It's a collective burden. It's a collective shame that we all share. So I think that that kind of white evangelicalism engenders a myopic transactional mentality, which, again, I don't think the average evangelical is responsible for. Their leaders are. Their leaders are. And at some point, their consciences should be pricked. I would hope that they would, that we wouldn't blindly follow leaders. But people
that's
have
just
more
what Wendell Pierce insight. Called John Kelly, by the way.
A leader.
A racist prick.
Okay. So I think there's
just
something about that.
Yeah, it just
so it's a transactional yeah. God, and the God of my youth is a God who delivers whole people. And that's what gives me hope as someone who does this work, who feels connected to my neighbor of whatever race or whatever religion and tries to take that seriously in an embodied way. In an embodied way. Mm. That's the only way I know how to live, and that really comes out of this very fundamental sense from the day I can remember the first cantata I heard in church, because we didn't have a hand-raising, clapping Baptist church. One woman got the Spirit, and that was it. And then I found out other black churches were different. But I heard God delivered Daniel, and I heard that Moses, God used Moses to deliver the Hebrew people, a prophet who was humble, or maybe disobedient, and said, me, God? And that's what distinguishes a prophet from someone who's rushing to be a martyr, right? They're often hesitant. So thank you for letting me speak with you. It's been an honor.
Oh, thank you.